This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, hundreds of thousands stand up to an attempt to privatize public services in Puerto Rico.
This may be the most militant demonstration in the last decades in Puerto Rico. Will the government of Puerto Rico ignore them?
We have more updates regarding Guantanamo prisoner releases and the recent news of the previously hidden abusive interrogation videotapes of Mohammed Al-Qahtani. Al-Qahtani was the victim of the first special interrogation plan. Stay with us. Michael, we haven't had an update on the status of the Uyghurs recently. What's happening?
Periodically, we try and give our listeners updates on Guantanamo detainees and particularly the Uyghur situation. The Uyghurs have become well known in the last couple of years for a couple of reasons. One is they're from Western China, and there's been huge suppression of Uyghur populations in Western China. A number of them, because of that, fled into Afghanistan and into Pakistan ultimately. And they did this not just in the last couple of years, but over the years as China has continued to repress the rights of the Uyghur people. During the Afghan War in 2001, 2002, a number of people were picked up in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and there were 19 or so Uyghurs who had nothing to do with terrorism, simply turned over by warlords for bounties. They've been sitting in Guantanamo. Now they is down to 13, but 13 have been sitting in Guantanamo for some 8 years and are still there. And so the question is, what's going to happen to those 13 who have been found innocent even by all of the military people as well as by the American courts?
What happened to the ones who were released? Where did they go?
Four went to Bermuda, a number went to Albania, and now there's supposedly a deal with some in Palau. But the interesting thing about the Uyghur case is the Supreme Court just last week granted review of the Uyghurs' cases. And it comes up in an interesting context. After winning the right of habeas corpus, the right to go to court to challenge your detention, which took three Supreme Court cases, the Uyghurs finally got their day in court last year. The court said there's nothing against them, and he wanted to order them released. And he did. The U.S. government came in first under Bush and said the court has no right to order them released into the United States, that that's up to the president and you can't do that. The case went up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals agreed with the government, the Bush administration at that point, saying the court can't order their release. So you have to ask yourself, well, what's the point of habeas corpus if you can't order someone's release? That's the whole purpose of habeas corpus. It's to give a person a hearing why they're being held and to say if there's no legal reason, legal justification for them to be held, they have to be released. So you're sitting at the end of the appeals court process with 13 people who the court has said there's no basis for holding them, but we're not going to order their release. So the lawyers, including the Center for Constitutional Rights and a person we've had on this show a number of times, Sabin Willett, who's from Bingham McCutcheon in Boston, asked for review in the Supreme Court. And the case has been sitting in the Supreme Court waiting for review for 6 months now, maybe more. Supreme Court didn't do anything. And all of a sudden, last week they acted and said we're going to review the cases of the Uyghur 13. And it's really significant because what they may have been saying to themselves on the court is, we're tired of this. How long can people stay in U.S. custody and just sit there without ever getting released? So the court is finally going to review the Uyghur case. It's really significant. It'll be argued most likely in late fall or probably, or after the first of the year.
But can the court essentially mandate the government to find homes in other countries for these remaining Uyghurs?
The court can do a couple of things here. It can order that the people be released in 10 days or a month. And then it's essentially saying to the United States, you either get these people to another country or you bring them in here. That's one way to do it. And it's actually the way we won our first Haitian Guantanamo cases. Early 90s, government, again, as the Obama administration is currently saying, the court can't order people into the United States. Bush 1 said they couldn't do it. Clinton said they couldn't do it. Bush 2 said they couldn't do it. Obama said they couldn't do it. And so what the court did in the Haitian cases was simply say, you have to release these people from Guantanamo and give them adequate medical treatment. The U.S. had no choice then but to bring them in. So what will, I hope, happen here, and of course it's hard to speculate because that court is very closely divided. 5-4 is how we won the right of habeas. But I assume that the five who gave us the right of habeas will say, once you have a right of habeas, you have to order release. I'm very hopeful on the Uyghur case. It'll be very significant. Of course, the government may try, and the Obama administration may try and moot the case by finding other countries like Palau and others, but there's many more after them. Out of the 36 habeas cases we have fought in the district court since we won, we have won 30 of them. 17 of those people, I think, still remain in Guantanamo. So this will not go away. And what's sad to me is here's the Obama administration continuing to say a court can't order them in. And, of course, our wonderful Congress has actually passed a law saying they can't come into the United States. So as much as I hesitate to say courts, particularly conservative courts, are critical to protecting civil liberties, in this case, they apparently are and will be. Heidi, I understand there's been some developments in the Shack 7 case. Why don't you first remind us, what is the Shack 7?
Shack 7 stands for Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. And essentially, seven activists several years ago, many of them from New Jersey, were indicted and convicted on charges that they had conspired. And I think it was based on an interstate theory that they used the internet to disseminate information that may have resulted in certain protests, say what we call home protests, in front of leaders of this corporation that tests animals and that animal welfare activists have been protesting for years.
Were they convicted in that case?
They were all convicted. They all did jail and prison time. Some are still inside.
Wow.
And the problem is there was really no basis under the law by which to convict them. It was clearly a political case. The jurors were swayed, I've heard, by some emotional testimony from, say, the heads of the corporations who felt intimidated. Now, that changes it to a subjective standard, how they felt. And the jurors went for that, and it could change the course of First
really
Amendment law.
That's quite important. Obviously, a lot of people are going to feel intimidated, in a sense, by their own standards if there's demonstrators in front of their house. That happens to us all the time.
Was that case appealed?
It was appealed, and this is the latest news. I just got an email that last week, while we were all at the National Lawyers Guild Convention in Seattle, the Third Circuit ruled with the lower court and upheld their convictions. And I think why this is important to mention is that we know there are many other so-called domestic terrorism cases going on, the so-called ADA 4, Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, four individuals in San Francisco. There are some in Utah. And the underlying premise is the same. Traditionally, First Amendment protected speech like leafleting, picketing, protesting in the San Francisco case is being challenged as being in effect related to domestic terrorism. So I think the Shack decision does not bode well for these other cases.
So let me ask, do I understand this correctly? People who would otherwise be exercising their First Amendment rights to speech and assembly are now imprisoned because the persons to whom they were protesting felt bad?
They claim they felt afraid. And I guess one could say that it's under a vague definition that is being written into anti-terrorism legislation in many states around the country, that if you feel you are being coerced or intimidated or in fear, that can be construed as related to domestic terrorism.
Well, I suppose if you put a gun to somebody's head, they could legitimately feel they were being coerced. But having picketers in a public place making a First Amendment protected demand shouldn't result in a criminal charge, should it?
It shouldn't. And I think what's dangerous is, again, jurors are being swayed by emotion rather than by the law.
Thank you.
Public services grinded to a halt on October 15th in Puerto Rico as a massive one-day general strike brought more than 200,000 people to protest the layoff of nearly 25,000 of Puerto Rico's public employees. The demonstration shut down all state-owned enterprises, including the island's schools and colleges. The airport remained open while tens of thousands were reported to converge on San Juan's Plaza Las Americas. Main labor organizations, the General Workers Union and the All Puerto Rico for Puerto Rico Coalition, supported the strike. In May of this year, the Puerto Rican government laid off nearly 8,000 employees and then hired about 3,000 temporary teachers and assistants. Union leaders claim that Governor Luis Fortuno is planning to privatize government services. Outrage to the proposed layoffs have rippled into New York City, amid the second largest community of Puerto Rican people. To discuss the proposed layoffs and strike, we're pleased to have with us attorney Judith Birkin, partner in the San Juan law firm of Birkin Mendez. Judith specializes in government misconduct litigation and employment discrimination cases.
Judith Birkin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Extraordinary general strike in Puerto Rico. More than 100,000 people came out with wide, wide support. It's like the old days in the United States in the 30s. What's going on down there? What's at stake?
The estimates, Michael, are in fact that it was closer to 200,000, and this is in a country that doesn't even have 4 million inhabitants. So it was truly huge. The entire country shut down for a day. This is the strike. The immediate impetus for the strike came about as a result of the firings of public workers, the dismissals are almost at 25,000. And the result of those dismissals is that basically any agencies that deal with service to the poor or the working class in Puerto Rico have basically been dismantled.
Wow.
This is one of several things that have happened. 2 days before the strike, the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill that is aimed at dismantling the Bar Association, which is a progressive organization here, a mandatory bar membership, which has always stood up for decolonization efforts, for efforts at community support, giving voice to women, minorities, labor interests, etc.
What are people doing there now? Is this like this is going to happen? Is it reversible? Bring us up to date on the fight back.
The country is demanding that this be reversed.
Judy, this being the reinstatement of jobs?
Yes, that the jobs be reinstated. The government, unfortunately, has shown an extraordinary arrogance, not only in this issue, but in basically all issues, in which they have very clearly stated that they're on a path that cannot be changed and they don't care if there are daily protests. And though the strike on October 15th was massive, there have been daily, every single day, protests by one sector or another, and that they're going to do whatever they want to do. And what they apparently want to do is return us to the days of the oligarchy, in which the wealth is concentrated in the hand of an extraordinarily small group of people, and the remainders pick up the crumbs.
Judy, can you give us some sense of the sectors that were out demonstrating and how broad a protest this involves?
Obviously, the students from every university, every sector of the labor movement, and there are sectors of the labor movement that are at odds between themselves, but all of them were out. The religious sector, cultural organizations, organizations of actors, of theater people, musicians, the Bar Association and attorneys, even the school principals, which is traditionally a very conservative group, 700 school principals declared their support. There were 2,000 janitors in the schools. Right now there are no janitors in the schools in Puerto Rico, and that's going to be privatized. Private companies will be doing that, so the janitors were out in force. It was just so broad, it's hard to give a sense. The downtown area of San Juan was just filled with different groups, and there were like 10 starting points for different groups to gather. They all converged on the center of San Juan.
Judith, how is the health care service responding? Are hospitals open?
On that day, it was limited to emergency services because, obviously, the hospital unions are some of the strongest unions here. But one of the problems is that with the dismissals of public workers, all those services are going to be severely impaired.
seems like a huge privatization effort. I mean, it reflects, of course, what has been going on in, for quite a number of years between the United States, England, and other places, and the Bush administration, what's still going on. But is there some reason there's a resurgence of this push for privatization in Puerto Rico right now?
Yeah, it's the particular colonial administration that was elected last November sort of goes against the trend was in Latin America. And
that's for sure.
is an extremely right-wing sector. I hesitate to say Republican because those parties are not particularly relevant here.
No, it sounds like it's a whole neoliberalism attack to roll back the New Deal, in a sense.
The privatization effort here is extreme. For example, I'll give you a couple of examples. The janitors were fired, 2,000 janitors from schools in the middle of a swine flu epidemic, I should say. Really problems with hygiene in the schools. And what the government intends to do in January is to put these out to bid for private companies to come in and do this. And that's just one. I mean, throughout, there's essentially every service. I mean, even in my law practice, on the Monday following the Friday firings of attorneys, private attorneys came in to to litigate the cases against me and representing the state.
So you've had cases involving this already, Judy?
Cases where I'm suing the state or government authorities. Instead of using the public employees who would normally represent the government on these cases, they're now using private counsel.
That's quite remarkable.
I mean, literally the Monday after the Friday of the dismissals, it's been very crude and very, you know, and the attitude is we're doing this and, you know, all the rest of you be damned.
Now, Judy, were there any arrests out of these protests or?
Very few. There were a few arrests about a week before the strike. There were some students who threw eggs and stones at a governor's cavalcade, and the riot troops invaded a school for the first time in about 30 years in Puerto Rico, actually went into the high school and arrested some minors. On the day of the demonstration, there were very few arrests. At the very end, there were some incidents, but it was by and large very peaceful.
Judy, within a few days before the demonstrations, our office received various calls, and on the day I got various calls about the governor's threat to charge people with terrorism under the Patriot Act. It apparently didn't happen, but what were these threats? How serious are they?
These were first made by what we call the Secretary of the Governance, who is the main executive, not the governor himself, and his name is Marcos Rodriguez Emma, who's forte has always been privatization, and he was brought into the government again. He'd been there before. And he went on a radio station, I believe, on Monday and said that he understood that if there was any blockage of commerce, that could be brought under the Patriot Act. And it was an attempt to intimidate people into not participating. We don't know if there's something going on. After that, the police superintendent in Puerto Rico, who's Jose Figueroa Sancha, who is an FBI man on loan to the colonial administration, he echoed those words and said that he understood that there were possible federal offenses.
And Judith, what part of the Patriot Act would they use against these movements for essentially social justice?
That they are terrorists. He said that they are terrorists and that they're trying to block commerce. I'm not familiar enough with the Patriot Act. Perhaps Michael knows it.
Yeah, there's a domestic terrorism part of it that was quite broad after 9/11. It really was aimed at Seattle-type demonstrations, at least arguably, and it could, with a stretch, be used.
But, I mean, the way that they framed it was, if you stop commerce, you know, and particularly they were talking about the docks and the airports, that would be sanctionable under federal law. I don't know if there was ever any intention to follow it through, but it was certainly an attempt to intimidate. And I don't think it was very successful because I think it made people angrier. This follows, just to give you a sense of the climate, since this new administration has come in, there have been a number of very offensive comments by the people in charge, you know, calling community leaders leeches and lowlifes, I mean, openly, basically saying, we're here to take as much of the wealth of this country that we can take and the rest of you, you know. And they've been very open about it.
Judith, is any of the police force sympathetic?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, I heard reports from people on the day of the strike that there were some police officers who were being very supportive the police force is traditionally a reactionary force here, of course, and particularly the specialized units like the tactical operations. It was relatively calm compared to other demonstrations over the years, and I think in part it's because they are public workers themselves. These dismissals have hit every family in Puerto Rico.
Judith, talk more about the Bar Association, because we're well aware that it's a progressive organization mm-hmm. in Puerto Rico. And what are they doing to fight back? What's going to happen?
Tune in next week. On Sunday, there's an emergency assembly. What the legislation has done is basically cut off the four sources of funding for the Bar Association, because the Bar Association receives its funding from both quotas, annual quotas, and from what we call stamps that you file in court. And those were both cut off. It's going to be made into a voluntary association, and I assume that the plans will be to make, if perhaps anything, a more militant organization.
Has that legislation passed already,
Judy? That legislation passed and was signed immediately by the governor.
When was that?
October 13th, 2 days before the strike.
And I wonder, because I got a couple emergency notes from lawyers there saying, call, and I guess that's what it was about.
Well, what happened was that this legislation was in the works for quite a while, since the new administration came in, and there had been some public hearings, and it was going to committee, and there were noises about the fact that a committee report would be issued shortly. And then, 2 days before the strike, they slipped it in without, it's a process called descargue, which is that you pass legislation without awaiting any of the reports, which is the normal legislative process. And the justification given at the time was that the Colegio was offering its professional support to the strike. It wasn't even at that time actually militantly supporting the strike. It was more saying that they would have observers to make sure that everything was done in an orderly fashion, that kind of thing, and there was no police brutality. You can explain what happened. One is that they wanted to destroy the Colegio anyway, and that if they did it 2 days before the strike, it would be another blow to the movement, and also that in the uproar leading up to the strike, it wouldn't get the attention that it required.
So how do you look going forward here? I mean, what do you anticipate? I mean, this sounds like the demonstrations sound like a tremendous fight back, but of course you seem to have a government, if you want to call it that, that's trying to ignore it. I mean, where do you see this going?
Well, I think I think the militancy will continue, and I don't think we've seen the last of general strikes here in Puerto Rico. I think there will be more. And as I say, there's almost a daily demonstration of one sort or another, and the pressure will be kept up. As to, the long run here, it's difficult to predict. I do think that there's been a very encouraging development in recent years in general, that they're also trying to destroy, but they can't destroy it. Community self-actualization, I don't know how to translate it from the Spanish exactly, but, where communities bound together and sort of are in some ways, it may be seen as taking the pressure off the government, but are essentially saying to the government, you're not providing for us, and we're going to provide for ourselves, and to work outside of all government structures. So there's that kind of movement. The intransigence of this administration is shocking, and I just don't know how long they're going to be able to sustain it, because the level of militants in the country in general is something that I have not seen in my 32 years here, the breadth of the opposition.
I didn't realize you were born in Puerto Rico.
32 years.
Judy, I have one last little request. There's obviously an utter absence of information on this issue, and where can people actually get more information?
It's a straight newspaper, but you can go to endi.com, which is it's in Spanish, is the primary, one of the principal newspapers here, or primerahora.com, and they have pretty strong updates. There's a number of other websites, contralautoridad.com. Most of them are in Spanish. I'm trying to think of an English language site, but we definitely need to get out the word.
Well, again, Judy, thank you very, very much for this and for, of course, all that you've done in the past.
Thank you so much.
Bye, Judy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Michael, you've known Judith Birkin for a number of years.
Well, I knew her actually through the center, but through the National Lawyers Guild even more, because the Guild actually had an office in Puerto Rico helping out with issues concerning Puerto Rican independence and Vieques. And this goes back a long way. This goes back to the 70s in what you might call the first Vieques struggle. It's not the one that finally won, but it, of course, contributed to it. And in that context, Judy Birkin and the National Lawyers Guild office played a very, very important role in representing demonstrators at Vieques. And I used to go to Puerto Rico often and occasionally argue the cases. And one of the cases I argued with a man named Harry Anduce. Harry Anduce is a Puerto Rican lawyer now on the board of the center and was head of the Puerto Rican Bar Association, very progressive independentista. And we argued Judy Birkin's case. Judy had been on Vieques as a legal observer. The protest was that they would pull their boats up to Vieques and then go on to the military base. They tried to go on to the military base, and then they would get arrested for trespass as part of the protest. Well, Judy was an observer, and they arrested Judy. And the cases all went to trial in the 70s sometime, and some with tragic endings because one of the people actually died in prison. But they all were given six-month sentences, including Judy, the lawyer who was there as an observer. And most of the Puerto Rican independentistas refused to do anything in the court and refused to appeal their sentences and just went to jail for the 6 months. Judy, because she was a lawyer, had the potential of being disbarred. And it was decided, not particularly necessarily by Judy, but, and I don't recall this, but somehow that we would do her appeal. And I and Harry Anduce did Judy's appeal. And the way the trial had gone is they convicted Judy of trespassing on the military base by crossing really what is an imaginary line, essentially, because under Puerto Rican law, the military base started at the high water mark. And so unless you went above the high water mark, you were not on the military base. In the trial court, they had someone get on the witness stand and testify, well, I saw Judy above the high water mark because she was standing on the dry sand, and everybody knows that the dry sand is above the high water mark, and the wet sand is below the high water mark, which is a public right to beaches.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
When I read that transcript of the trial, it didn't make any sense to me because I know that tides change.
That's right.
Winter tides are higher than summer tides, and you can't just tell the high water mark by looking at wet sand versus dry sand. And there was no Lexis, no electronic research at that time for me to find a case that actually talked about high watermark. But ultimately, I found a Supreme Court case that defined high watermark for the purposes of U.S. and Puerto Rican law, which said it's the average over 18 years of the winter tides. It's essentially an imaginary line. And without actually having surveyors come in and do that on the beach, and of course, how would Judy have known where it was anyway, you couldn't say that Judy and others were above the high water mark. In fact, we could have gotten everybody off. So I go to Puerto Rico because they argue the courts of appeals cases out of Boston in Puerto Rico for the month of February. And interestingly, on the panel was Judge Breyer, who's now a Supreme Court justice. And I argue the case, and Judge Breyer is quite good on it. At that point, one of the more conservative judges say, what is this? This isn't a land court. What are we talking about here? And I just kept persisting and persisting. And ultimately, we won the case, got Judy off of her six-month sentence, got the conviction thrown out because they could never prove that she was above the high water mark. I can't say Judy's here today, and she would never allow that because Judy is, you know, an incredibly strong, militant litigator and, you know, one of the strongest. But the fact that she was willing, even back 30 years ago, to take these kind of risks is just remarkable.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later gotta cut you down, sooner or later gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
We have more updates regarding Guantanamo prisoner releases and the recent news of the previously hidden abusive interrogation videotapes of Mohammed al-Qahtani. Al-Qahtani, as many may remember, was the victim of the first special interrogation plan, personally overseen by former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. As the January date for closing Guantanamo looms near, we'll also find out how the Obama administration is doing in its promise to shut it down. Joining us today is Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Pardis Cabriai.
Pardis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Pardis, it's been a while since we've gotten a generalized update on what's going on with Guantanamo. I want to ask you some questions about that. The first thing is, I know that one part of what you're doing is you represent some people who died in Guantanamo, two of them at least, in a civil case, and you can tell us about that against various U.S. officials. Mm-hmm. And what's going on in those cases?
Right. Well, this is the part of Guantanamo that's about accountability. I mean, this is really about holding people responsible for what's happened in the past, and that continues to happen in terms of abuse. So this case is one we filed in 2008 on behalf of two men who died in Guantanamo in June of 2006. On June 10th of 2006, there were actually three deaths, and we represent the families of two of the men who died. Their names are Yasser al-Zahrani from Saudi Arabia and Salah al-Salami from Yemen. Salah actually still has a brother who's still in Guantanamo, still detained. But we brought this case against 24 officials, including Rumsfeld, including Michael Leonard, Jeffrey Miller, people who were in charge of and approved torture techniques to be used in interrogations. Among our defendants also are Vance Craddock, who introduced a policy of force feeding in Guantanamo that's still in effect, whereby detainees are literally strapped into chairs that are called restraint chairs, euphemistically, but they're essentially strapped in at 5 points, at their forehead, their shoulders, their wrists, ankles, and waist, while a tube is forced up their noses and down into their stomachs, and formula is pumped into their stomachs for about an hour. And then they remain seated like that for another hour while the food is digested so that the military can ensure that they don't regurgitate the formula. That was a policy that was introduced by Craddock, so he's named in the complaint. Also named are some medical physicians who we argue knew or should have known or definitely knew by virtue of reports from the International Red Cross, by virtue of their own medical staff, things that were being reported about mental health problems among detainees, about just the devastating impact that conditions and isolation and the torture were having on people, knew about those things that were happening and yet, at the very least, turned a blind eye.
I think the center is running a website. I think it's called When Healers Harm, is that right?
That's correct. And it's specifically about the accountability piece of focusing on the medical personnel and the medical officials who were in Guantanamo and have a professional duty and an oath to protect and ensure the health and well-being of men who were detained there and, in fact, participated in interrogations that affirmatively did things to harm And if not, you know, as we argue in our brief, at the very least did nothing. When they knew there was an impact on detainees, they continued to sort of maintain the policies and do nothing.
Now, the government claims that these two deaths were suicides. Is that right?
They claim that they reported suicides. It took 2 years. I mean, interestingly, when they died, before there was any autopsy conducted, before there was any investigation, they came out immediately to the press and announced them as apparent suicides. Some of the officials in our complaint said more. They called them asymmetrical warfare or a good PR move. Those are statements that have, you know, sort of infamously now connected with those deaths. But it took 2 years for the military to conduct and finish its investigation. In the end, after 2 years, they concluded the same thing, that they were suicides. But the problem with that is that there's just been no transparency. I mean, this is the government side of the story. There's obviously no ability we have to go back in time and interview people who were around at the time, to interview the men themselves. Obviously, they're dead. So there's nothing we can do in terms of verifying or getting our own information about what happened.
Now, you had a recent filing in these death cases this last week.
Yeah.
What's going on?
So we filed on Monday an opposition to a motion to dismiss that these officials filed. They want to get rid of the case, essentially, and we filed our opposition to it. And their starting point, their first argument, is that these kinds of claims that involve conditions of confinement that bring up issues of torture and abuse are barred by the Military Commissions Act of 2006. And what that act did is there's a provision of it, Section 7, where the first part is what we challenged in the habeas case of Boumediene versus Bush. And that provision, the first part of it, barred the power of any federal court in the United States to hear challenges to the legality of the detention of anyone in Guantanamo. And that was the habeas part of it. And Boumediene clearly ruled that, struck down that part of Section 7. We argue it struck down all of Section 7, Boumediene. What the government is now arguing is that there's a second part to that provision that bars federal courts from hearing any other case relating to any other aspect of detention, treatment, conditions, anything else. They argue that that section remains alive.
So let me see if I understand this. No matter what happened to you in Guantanamo, if a U.S. official put a gun to your head and fired a bullet through it, mm-hmm. you couldn't sue that U.S. official or the U.S. because of this Military Commission Act provision that said no Guantanamo detainee can bring any lawsuit.
That's correct. They are basically saying there is no court in the United States that has the power to hear those kinds of claims. So they are essentially arguing for the same legal black hole theory that they were using in the habeas context, but now they're using it in the context of trying to eliminate the power of any court in the U.S. to hear claims of torture, abuse. You die in Guantanamo, whatever happens in Guantanamo stays in Guantanamo. That's what they're saying.
So that's the key part of what you filed in this case last week.
That's the key part of it, and what's different about this case is that it's the first time the government has raised that issue. There are not very many cases like this that have been filed in terms of damages claims or claims about the torture or abuse of detainees who have been released or who have died. There's one case that's pending where cert has been sought before the Supreme Court, but this issue of the Military Commissions Act and this provision that bars jurisdiction has not been raised in that case.
What's really interesting to me is, of course, this Military Commission Act was passed in 2006 mm-hmm. under the Bush administration, and yet it was never raised by the Bush administration.
Right.
And now we're with the Obama administration, and for the first
right.
time they're trying to use the bar that's contained in this act, the so-called
right.
bar, to get rid of these two death cases.
Right. That's right. So we're challenging the constitutionality of that provision, and it's the first time that that's come up in one of these cases, so it'll be important going forward to see what happens.
There was another development I want to ask you about in the last week or so, and that's with the center's client, Mohammed El-Khatani, mm-hmm. and it concerns audio or videotapes of what most likely amounts to his torture. Can you tell us what context that came in and what's really important about what's going on there?
For 7 months, we've been briefing the issue of discovery in that case, and the government has consistently denied the existence of these kinds of tapes. Finally, it's come out that they do exist. The judge in his case has ordered the government to release them to us, so this is a major development because it documents essentially what he was going through, the torture he was experiencing prior to the time when he made statements allegedly that the government is now relying on in his case.
Let me back up for a second. Mohammed El-Khatani is the one that I think maybe a lot of our listeners know about, who was the first Guantanamo detainee that at least we have documented in a log that was subject to the so-called Rumsfeld 15 techniques mm-hmm. of interrogation. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying to us now, we didn't know actually that there were any video, at least I didn't know there were any video or audio tapes mm-hmm. made of, not just that, of any prior interrogations of Mohammed El-Khatani. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, this is a real revelation, at least to us who are out there and not don't have the security clearance to look into that case. That's what's one of the things that's so surprising, I guess.
That's right. And in terms of the interrogation plan that he was subjected to, I mean, these are methods that I think everyone knows about or has read about, but they included things like 20-hour interrogations, forced nudity, you know, prolonged solitary confinement, using dogs, sexual abuse, those kinds of things. And that's what he was subjected to, and those are the methods that were specifically approved by Donald Rumsfeld in 2002 and requested by commanders at Guantanamo for use on Mohammed El-Khatani. So there is now, you know, the revelation about the existence of tapes documenting abuse that he went through prior to the time when he allegedly made statements the government's relying on. So in terms of proving, you know, the extreme torture he was subjected to and undermining the credibility of anything he might have said, statements that are being used in his habeas case right now to continue to detain him that may be used in the future, this is an incredibly important development.
You know, it's extraordinary because the only tapes that at least we've been aware of other than these of torture and abuse were the so-called waterboard tapes, most of which, if not all of which, were supposedly destroyed. Mm-hmm. So this is really the first revelation of the documentation of interrogation, abuse, and torture that at least the public has known about.
Right. There were some, that, I mean, in very different context and very different client, but some tapes that were released about Omar Khadr that show his interrogations. I mean, they weren't at all, I think, of the nature of what we might see in this context, but they do just show a glimpse of just how devastating the treatment that detainees were subjected to. I mean, you see Omar in these tapes just breaking down with interrogators. He was, you know, 15 at the time, I think.
You know, you're right. I remember watching the tape and how devastated I was by his crying and asking for his mother. Now I'd like to take you to the bigger picture of Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. We know that President Obama has signed an order saying he wants the prison closed by sort of middle to late January. Roughly around then, and just overall, how is that process going? What are your expectations? What do you think is going to happen?
Mm-hmm. It is going slowly, and we are getting more and more concerned, as now in the past week or two, there have been pretty clear statements by Holder and others that the January deadline is not going to be met.
How many people are left in Guantanamo?
There are 223 by our count. There have only been, since January, since Obama took office and vowed to close Guantanamo within a year, there have been 18 people transferred. I mean, that is extraordinary. Of the 223 people who remain, 97 of them, by our count, are Yemeni. These are people who, obviously 97 is a large number, there are people with different needs, different interests, so I don't want to speak for the whole group, but I can say with some certainty that a large number of them would want to return to Yemen. There are no resettlement issues like exist with respect to other men who can't return to their home countries, where the U.S. needs to engage in, you know, protracted diplomatic discussions to find homes for them. These are people who can return to Yemen, people who the Yemeni government has asked for, who remain in Guantanamo, are now almost half of the population there. I think a very good example of the U.S. creating its own mess and its own problem and these delays is the fact that there are people who've even won their habeas petitions, where you have a federal judge determining, ordering that there is no lawful basis for detention, and they remain in Guantanamo, and some of them are Yemeni. And a recent example is the case of an individual by the name of Ala Ahmed, who is Yemeni, won his case in May. A federal judge, Judge Kessler, ruled that there was no basis for his detention, that the government had absolutely no credible evidence against him. And he sat in prison in Guantanamo for over 4 months before finally, because his judge essentially just wasn't going to put up with it any longer, finally ordered the government to set a certain date for his transfer, and he's now back in Yemen. But these are the kinds of people there are now. You know, there have been 38 cases that have been heard so far, habeas cases. Of those 38, 30 have won their petitions. And of those 30, 19 people still remain in Guantanamo.
That's remarkable. So a federal court has said that 30 people ought to be released, mm-hmm. and still of those 30, 19 are at Guantanamo.
Right. And some of them, you know, the government might argue that it takes a while, it'll take a while to find resettlement countries for people who can't return to their home countries. There may be something to that, but there are people who can return home. There are Kuwaitis, for example, who've won their cases who are sitting in Guantanamo, want to return to Kuwait. There's another Yemeni who wants to return to Yemen. Separate from the people who've won their habeas petitions, there are people who've been cleared by Obama's review process, nearly 80 people now, and this information was recently publicly disclosed. Obama had set up a review process when he took office to review the files of everyone who's sitting in Guantanamo and determine whether they could be released or what the disposition of their case would be. By now, 80 people have been cleared through that process where the government has itself determined that there is no rationale for continuing to detain them. And they're still in Guantanamo. And of that group, we know that 27 is what the government is saying. 27 Yemenis have been cleared through that process. Again, these are people who can go home. You don't have the issue of needing to find a third country and negotiate diplomatically with the Europeans or whoever else to find a safe haven. These are people who can go home and want to go home.
You know, what's remarkable about it is, you know, I think if you talk to, like, the person in the street, they would say, well, we probably have left at Guantanamo the worst of the crowd, of the 750 people who passed through there. But in fact, from what you're saying, it appears that nationality is a key determining factor in who gets out of there.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the Yemenis, were not always the largest group. There were far more, twice as many probably, Saudis and Afghans, for example. Those people are almost all home by now, and that's because of the political relationship between the nature of the relationship, I think, between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and certain leverage and influence that that country was able to exert that Yemen has not been able to. Or it's because, I think, with the Afghans, frankly, the U.S. itself was able to exert its own control over the terms of the transfers of those Afghans. So a large number of them, after 2007 or so, were only transferred on the condition that they continued to be detained in another prison in Afghanistan. And I think because of the nature of that relationship, the U.S. was able to sort of force those conditions on the transfers that happened. With Yemen, what's happening is, I think you have a country that hasn't been able to exert, you know, its own influence necessarily, and the U.S. also hasn't been able to fully force its own conditions for maybe continuing detention. I don't know exactly, but I'm sure there are certain conditions that the U.S. is asking of Yemen in order to transfer citizens back. I think the Yemenis are not agreeing to that, yet they haven't been able to sort of force things the other way and force the return of their citizens. So there's just been this deadlock for years. Ala Ahmed's transfer, you know, just a week ago or so, was the first one since 2008. Prior to that, I think there was only one in 2007. There have only been a total of 13 or 14 Yemenis ever who've been returned to Yemen. It's really staggering.
It's remarkable. Before I get to the final question about what you expect to happen over the next few months and how many, whether they're going to keep it open or not, I had a question about Congress. I saw some recent note, at least about the House, passing another sense of Congress or something about Guantanamo. It doesn't seem like they're exactly the friends of wanting to close the place.
Right. I saw something about the Senate passing a measure, a war measure, that included a provision specifically banning the transfer of any detainee to the United States. And I think the position of the Congress and the U.S. on that has been a huge issue, a huge reason, or a major reason why the United States has not been able to find resettlement countries more quickly. It's pretty indefensible for the United States to go to European countries or other countries and ask them to resettle detainees in Guantanamo when the U.S. is not willing to do the same thing.
It is amazing to me. In fact, in the House resolution or the House sense of Congress last week, I think it said not only can no one be transferred here for release or for being put in prison, but no one can be transferred here for trial even.
Right, right. I mean, it's extreme.
And these are many Democrats, sadly, who voted, I think, in the House case. Right. 80 Democrats voted for that resolution.
Right. And I mean, we're talking about, you know, taking even, I think symbolically, even taking two or three people in this entire country would just symbolically be a huge step. And I think that would have allowed other countries to just fall in step and much more quickly accept detainees. You know, things were put off and delayed for months because European countries were just not willing to contribute to solving the problem when the U.S. was not going to do it itself.
What's going to happen? I mean, he has a January, end of January sort of deadline coming. What's going to happen? Guantanamo going to stay open? What do you expect?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what we're hearing from the administration is that it is going to close. It's just that it may not be by January. What we're trying to do from our end is really just push as hard as we can with European countries and countries like Canada that haven't taken anyone yet to really underline that there are innocent people who have now been in prison for almost 8 years, and it's just not a solution to sit back any longer. There are countries that have made commitments and said they would be willing to take detainees that haven't acted yet. So I think we're just going to be pushing as hard as we can for those transfers to happen. They've been trickling. I mean, they've been happening very slowly. Hopefully we can build on the momentum and make them happen more quickly. As for Yemen, I think it's not difficult. It doesn't have to be a major issue. Most of those people can go home and their country wants them back. But as far as what the administration is going to do, I know there's been talk of perhaps trying to find a transfer solution in Saudi Arabia and sending them to a rehabilitation program in Saudi Arabia. I have no idea if that's going to happen. I think it's not the right thing. It's just outrageous to me that people wouldn't have a right to return to their own home country when they don't have a fear of it, who are innocent. But as far as what's actually going to happen, I think the U.S. clearly has made it known that they do not want to transfer Yemenis back to Yemen. I am assuming past January, you know, Guantanamo may stay open for a few months, and I think the U.S. has made clear also that they want to transfer remaining prisoners to prisons in the U.S. It's anybody's guess at this point, but we're going to push as hard as we can to get our clients out.
I know you and the Center for Constitutional Rights have been working on this for years, and of course our expectations were when Obama took office that we'd get a faster change, but as you pointed out, innocent people for 7 years are now going on innocent people for 8 years. And, of course, every single day to me is a legal and moral outrage. So thank you, Pardis.
Thank you very much. Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.